Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking about house flipping, achieving FIRE, and staying frugal with Carl Jensen.
So today we're talking with Carl Jensen, who is known on the interwebs as Mr. 1500, which we'll get to here in a little bit, where the name came from, why he chose the Mr. 1500 moniker. But Carl, he found himself trapped in a cubicle as a software developer nearly 9 years ago, and he set off on a journey to achieve the status of financially independent and retired early. He has since achieved FIRE and continues to be incredibly productive in real estate with his live and flips, all while pursuing a very intentional life in Longmont, Colorado. And an important note too is that Carl is a good friend of ours who we met years ago. And after spending some more time together recently at a personal finance conference, we realized we were overdue in having him come on the show as a guest. So Carl, thank you for joining us.
Joel, Matt, I am so happy to be here. This doesn't happen to be show 1500, is it?
Oh, no, I wish. Okay, how about we could have reached out to you 5 years from now, Carl, but we decided to do it now instead.
It might be like 7 years from now, to be honest. We'll yeah, see.
Well, once we get to 7 episodes a week, it's going to be much quicker.
Okay, I reserve show 1500. If you don't have me on there, I'll be very angry.
No.
We will bring you on.
We'll put that in the show notes or in our little topics document that we have now. We'll slot you in for that episode already. And Carl, as you know, by the way, our listeners, let them in. Carl and I nerd out, and Matt and I nerd out on beer quite a bit. Carl, you love beer just as much as we do. And so, as you know, we drink a craft beer on every episode. It's something that we're splurging on in the here and now while saving and investing for the future. Yeah, what's your craft beer equivalent? What do you splurge on?
Oh, can I have multiple? I'm sorry, I'm going to be a pain in the butt. Can I
Please
say?
Do, yeah.
Okay. Totally fine.
Drop a couple. Okay.
So the things that I use in my day-to-day life provide a lot of value. Like if I don't have a good phone or a good laptop, if those things fail me, they're going to make my life miserable. So I spend a lot of money on a good phone. I try to keep them for 4 years. My computer is an Apple MacBook. I bought that in 2014. It's still going strong. It still gets security updates. And I think it has one more OS update. And I depend on those things. If my computer craps out, that's bad. So I'm not afraid to spend money there. My other two things are tools. I do a lot of work around the house.
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, it's similar to my phone or my computer. If my drill fails or my battery starts on fire or something like that, my day is going to be mad, and I will be mad, and I'm going to be set back. So I spend good money on tools. None of that. There's a chain that I won't mention, but if you know anything about tools, you know what I'm talking about. And the other thing is, and I kind of feel bad about saying this because I'm a pretty frugal guy, but I have owned an expensive car. It was an Acura NSX. I have since gotten rid of it, and I sold it for exactly what I bought it for. But sometime in the next 12 to 18 months, I will probably buy a brand new Tesla, which will be the most expensive car I've ever bought and most expensive thing I've ever bought besides a house. So feel free to judge. It's especially ridiculous since I don't have much of anywhere to drive. I take my bike and walk. But when I do a road trip, it'll be nice to have a nice car as opposed to the old, very old ones that we have now.
Most definitely. Yeah, when you have that Tesla, you can definitely count that as your splurge.
Yeah.
But definitely going to be worth it. Man, I'm totally with you, though, when it comes to tools. And we're going to talk actually more later on the show about your live and flips and just a lot of the work that you're doing. But before we get to that, man, we wanted to talk about FIRE. And so let's just broadly ask you here, like, what led you down that financial independence, retire early rabbit hole initially? Can you share some about that?
Yeah. So I was a software developer for a medical device. It was pretty stressful. If I messed up the code, I could kill someone. So I always, right?
High stakes. Yeah.
I never, ever did that. But I always had this cloud hanging over my head. I would think to myself, what happens if I introduced an error into the code like yesterday or even 4 years ago that suddenly surfaces that injures someone? My life is going to be miserable. And then one day it came out that I might have done that, and it actually turned out to be good. But in the meantime, it gave me incredible stress. This was back in October of 2012. I think I lost about 10 pounds in that week. I remember being huddled over the toilet thinking I was going to throw up. It was Very, very bad. Yeah, yeah. So at that time, I Googled, how do I retire early? And I had no idea anything like FIRE existed. And then up came Mr. Money Mustache and J.D. Roth. I'm like, holy crap. Here's these two dudes saying they retired at like 31 or something like that. I think J.D. might have been a little bit older. My first thought was, this has to be some kind of scam. Like, what kind of MLM are they going to try to sell me? Or
what kind of leggings are they selling?
Yeah, where is this going? But then I saw the Mr. Money Mustache article on the 4% rule, and I'm like, you know, I don't want to live like that, dude. $24,000 sounds like too little. But the whole thing is just a pretty simple math problem. And it was at that time I realized that FIRE was the real thing, and I was going to do this. So again, that was back in October 2012, and I ended up quitting my job in April of 2017.
Wow. So you don't live alone though, Carl. You've got a wife, you've got children. So this is one of those things where you can't just like go storming off and quitting your job. You've got mouths to feed. So what were those conversations like with your wife, Mindy, who's also our mutual friend? We've had Mindy on the show before. I'm guessing because she is also frugal, that conversation went okay.
Yeah, I was really surprised actually, because that story I told you about having the bad day and discovering those sites and then telling Mindy all happened in the course of maybe an hour. So I remember I was in my office and I ran out to the kitchen and I'm like, hey, Mindy, you know how stressed I've been? She's like, yeah. Well, I discovered these websites about early retirement. And it turns out since we've been already saving money and we're pretty frugal, that I could probably quit my job in like four years or so. And then I wouldn't have to deal with any of this. She was like, oh, okay, that sounds great. I trust you with the math. I'm like, okay, let's do this. And that was all there is to it, and that's about how long it took. The other funny thing was, at that time, I told her I was going to start a blog to write about it, and she's like, that's a horrible idea. That's just ridiculous. So she was okay with my insane idea of retiring at like in my 30s or early 40s, but not okay with starting a website. So There you have it.
I mean, I think a lot of folks would be envious, honestly, at the ability for you to get your partner on board in maybe what sounds like a 5-minute conversation. Is this so? Was she always on board? Like, so did y'all make any kind of crazy heart pivots? Did you make any drastic lifestyle changes as you kind of started to pursue FIRE?
Oh my God. I want to back up a second and comment on what you just said. I'm so bleeping fortunate that I have a partner that's on the same level as money. If you hear about this all the time with people saying, I found FIRE, but my partner isn't into it. My partner wants this and this car or wants this and this. And how do I convince them? And it's not an easy problem. And we could discuss that more if you want to, but I'm very, very fortunate that I had a spouse that was on the same level. I'm thankful for that every single day. We didn't have to pivot too much. We had two old cars, 2003 Honda Element and 2010 Mazda 5. But what we did do is we sold our house. We were living in this pretty nice luxury home. It had four beds, four bathrooms. It was a bit over 400,000 square feet. We sold that nice house and moved to a two-bedroom, one-bathroom that was infested with bugs, ants, and had a clogged sewer line, which I found out after a visit to Taco Bell the previous day. I can't make stuff like this up.
And so was it, are you glad you made that move? Like, how did that end up? Because that's a drastic change to go from 4,000 square feet to a crummy 2-1.
Yeah, it was 1,400 square feet. And the thing about it is, I can't make this up, we were happier in the crappy house because we had better community and people. You know, that's kind of a judgmental word. I should go back and not say better. We had people around us who shared our values more than our previous community. In our previous community, it seemed like a rat race. All the high school kids had nicer cars than we did. They all their kids had fancy toys, and our kid actually got judged for not having an American Girl doll, but that's another story. This new neighborhood, and I'll disclose that it's Longmont, the home of Mr. Money Mustache, who acts as a tractor beam for frugal-minded people, was just great. We fell in love with it immediately. There was people on our block that brought us a pie when we first moved in, and we're like, these are our people. So this house is crummy. We're all sleeping in the same bedroom for a short amount of time while I fix things up. We got to do something about the wayward sewer line. But we were happier in the crustier house, and we eventually fixed it up.
Well, so you said that, Mindy, she wasn't as excited about you starting that site. your blog. Let's talk about that for a second. So first of all, why did you pick 1500 days as the goal for reaching that work endpoint? Because you explained early on when you started the site. Can you elaborate on that some?
Yeah, so before I discovered any of this, we were pretty frugal and saved a lot of money. So we had about a little bit over 500,000 saved up, and we had 150,000 in home equity. I determined, and I just pulled this number out of my back end, that we would need about $1 million and no debt to retire. That turned out not to be true. So then I did some calculations based on my income, and the stock market returning about 10%, which was probably a little bit silly to count on such a thing. But then it turned out the stock market returned better than 10%, and I made a little bit more money than I thought. So anyway, the 1,500 days was the amount of money I thought it would take to accumulate that goal. And it actually happened about a year earlier, which was pretty cool. Very lucky and fortunate.
So, you know, you came out and told Mindy about FIRE, and you said, I want to start this blog. And why the blog, though? Why was it like, hey, I want to share all my information, or I want to document it on the internet? What was the purpose behind that in your mind? And then, yeah, like, how's that been for you? Initially, you were doing it under a pseudonym. Now, more people know who you are. But what was the impetus behind documenting it all?
Yeah, I thought it would be pretty cool to share my journey with the world. I also thought it would help to keep me accountable if I had to share my numbers and my purchases and my budget with the world. I'm going to be less likely to do something stupid. And the third reason, and this reason is the one I was most unsuccessful with, was I wish we were all a little bit open about money. We keep it as such a guarded thing in our lives. Like, what are the three things we don't talk about? Sex, religion, and money. But
right.
And why don't we talk about money? It's so silly. If we did, we could get over it and help each other out. It drives me a little bit nuts in our society. There's always these lists in Fortune magazine about the top 10 billionaires or the top billionaires under 30. And we put money on this huge pedestal. It would be nice if we put something else on a pedestal, like what we volunteer or how much money we give away or what we give back, instead of worshiping people for money. So in my dream world, we would all talk about money openly, and then we would get over it and help each other out. I think there'd be less need or want for status symbols, because sometimes I think we buy or finance nice cars to show people that we have money that we don't actually have.
Yeah, and it's a balancing act, though, too, right? Because we don't want to disclose every single personal thing about ourselves. Like, folks have different levels of knowledge that they're comfortable sharing with folks. But for you, you're obviously a little more comfortable sharing your figures out there with everyone. Have you found that there's been any downsides, you know, to the public nature of sharing all of your specific financial details?
Like, has anyone showed up at your doorstep and said, can I have a loan, please, Carl?
Yeah, I always thought we would be anonymous, and I still kind of wish we were, because there are safety issues with this. If you really want to find me, you could. I'm sure all your listeners are perfectly well-adjusted people, and none of them will show up on our doorstep. But if they do, we have security cameras. So. but by the way, I love meeting people. But yeah, people will send us. I've received snail mail and emails for people asking for money. And I've always responded to them, telling them that, hey, I don't have money to give you, but I'd like to help you if I can. Let's see how we can get your finances together. And that's going to be of more long-term benefit to you. And funny enough, no one ever responds to that. They just want $1,000 or whatever they want.
Oh, there's no check in the return envelope? I'm ripping this up.
No check. Maybe some Monopoly money.
Guy wants to give me advice? Lame.
Yep.
Well, Carl, you finally did quit, right? Like, roughly 4 years later. What, in your estimation, have been the biggest benefits of not working? And how has your life changed since you hit that fine number in 2017?
Oh, man. Jeez, I could talk about this forever. One thing I want to start out by saying is FI will not change who you are, and it won't really change much about your life happiness, if that makes any sense. So it's definitely a lot better, but you're still the same person that you were when you had a job. So I thought when I quit, like, rainbows would pop out, it would start raining beer, and there'd be like a chocolate fountain pop out of my backyard. And then none of those things happened. I knew life was better, but I wasn't necessarily happy. So I started researching happiness, and it turns out like half of happiness is genetic, 40% is your intentional living, and 10% is your circumstances. So FIRE is only a circumstance. It's not that much of a happiness improvement for your life. So I realized that there were other things I had to work on. So my message to your listeners is to don't expect fire to solve your problems. If you have issues with your wife or you have issues with yourself, which I did, you have to start working on them now. Don't wish your days away because you think this thing is going to help you. But on the positive side, it was great. I would always get these emails asking me if I wanted to volunteer at my kids' Valentine's Day party or this or that. So as soon as I quit, I could do all those things. You know, it was so awesome. That's awesome. I remember the first one I went to, I think it was my younger daughter's Valentine's Day party. She's running around with all her friends. And then at one point, she locked eyes with me and ran up to me and said, "Dad," I'm like, "What? What's going on?" She's like, "I'm so happy you could be here with me." And I'm like, I almost cried, and she read off, and she's probably forgotten the whole thing by then. But it's the little moments like that, and
being
able to take walks with your children in the middle of the day in summer and ride bikes. And time is the best thing you can give your kids. And now that I have fire, I can give my kids time, and it's infinitely valuable. I'm so thankful.
I think, I mean, like you said, it doesn't. It's just 10%. It's 10% of your overall happiness. But money is only just a portion of those overall circumstances. And so I think, yeah, like you said, you know, reaching
a lot of free
fire,
things you can do to change those circumstances.
Yeah, and reaching, I mean, fire, that's just one, like a status of the money that you have. Like money is, it's just an amplifier of who you already are. And so obviously you had these desires to spend more time with your kids, to kind of lead that type of life. And so just in regards to work, you know, do you think that the FIRE movement gets anything wrong, like when it comes to the value of work? Because Carl, for you specifically, it seems like you are working just as hard right now as you were before you quit working.
Oh, yeah. The FIRE movement totally gets the work part wrong. I totally agree with financial independence, and everyone should try to achieve that no matter how much you like your job. But to retire early, if you love your job and would do your work for free, why would you ever quit? Stay there, become financially independent, because your job might not always love you back, but there's no reason to quit. I love talking about this, because as soon as I quit, I thought maybe I took the internet retirement pleas to heart. I thought, you know, you're not supposed to be doing work. I'm going to not allow myself to code anymore. I'm not going to allow myself to build stuff. I'm retired now. I should be spending my day riding my bike and hiking and doing all this fun stuff. And then I kind of went into a depression, and then you realize like meaningful work gives you purpose, and that purpose gives you happiness. So that's what FIRE is all about. It's to do the work that really, really gets you moving deep down, and that work may or may not pay money, but you need to always make sure that work pays you in happiness. And oddly enough, some of it will pay you in money. I've made money unintentionally and intentionally after I've quit, but the main thing I need to make sure of and always have to be sure of is that whatever work I'm doing gives me happiness, because if it's not, I'm wasting my time and I should be doing something else because I have enough money and don't need any more.
Yeah. Well, Carl, I love your philosophy. I love that we're getting into this. And speaking of work, one of the things that you do for work is you have been doing live-in flips, and there's a lot of specific, I think, information that our listeners can get from you based on having done it multiple times. And there's a lot of like specific nuance, and live-in flips can be particularly lucrative for some folks. We'll talk more about that right after this break.
All right, we are talking with Carl Jensen, and just before the break, we were talking about just the different views that we have towards work, finding meaningful work, even if you're getting paid or if you're not getting paid. And so, Carl, let's talk about live and flips here for a second. For you, you know, this has been a great way to have meaningful work now that you don't have a traditional 9-to-5, and it's been a great source of income for you too. Is that right? Can you explain to our listeners what you've been up to regarding live and flips?
I love live-in flips. So I'll start off by saying, I'm sure you've probably discussed this on some episode, but buying a house isn't the investment that people think it is, right? Like houses usually appreciate it. Now might be a little bit of anomaly with COVID going on. But houses don't usually appreciate much more than the average rate of inflation. And that goes back to like the late 1800s, I think. You two might know more than me. Have you talked about this before on a show?
We have, yeah, and you're right. We are in a completely a time period that is unlike any other, and so I think, especially after the downturn in the Great Recession of 2008, it's one of those things where people like people can get burned, right? And then since then, we've seen steady appreciation, really great appreciation in home prices, partly because of that downturn. But yeah, some of the real estate agents and stuff I know are like, they make these promises to home buyers, and some of those things are unlikely to come true. The home prices don't go up at hockey stick level like this most of the time, right?
No, there is a ceiling, and as soon as interest rates start going up, I think we might see some of that ceiling coming. But yeah, right. Live-in flips are really great, and I'll tell you how I got into my first one. We had bought this house. It was my first house. It was about $140,000, and I had called up a plumber to fix this faucet leak, and he came over. He's like, yeah, I'll be back over tomorrow. It'll be like $120 to fix. And then he never showed up, and I was pretty angry because I had the money already. He said he was going to show up, so I went to the library. I'm pretty old, so this is before YouTube. And sure enough, there was a book on how to fix this. I went to Home Depot or whatever the big box was, bought this gasket, and fixed it for like $1.25. And then this plumber called up like a week later. He's like, yeah, I'm finally ready to do your job. And I'm like, nope, I already did it myself. Thank you, but no thank you. And then my next thought was, that wasn't that hard. How hard can all this other stuff be? Let's try to do some tile. Yeah, let's try to do some simple electrical stuff. We put in ceiling fans. Let's redo the kitchen. How hard is it to hang a cabinet? And it turns out much of it wasn't that hard. So this house that we bought for $140,000, we found ourselves selling it for $240,000 a couple of years later, mostly because of these improvements we made. And the key thing about this is, or one of the key things is, there's this IRS rule called the 2 out of 5 year rule. Mm-hmm. So if you have lived in a home for 2 of the past 5 years and owned it for 2 of the past 5 years, you pay no capital gains. So there were some transaction fees involved. So we probably came out with like $80,000, something like that. But we walked away with all that money in our pocket. And at that time, I was making like $37,000 a year. So Mindy and I looked at each other. I'm like, let's do this again. Let's find a house with pink toilets and blue bathtubs and ugly brown cabinets. Yeah, let's find the ugliest house in the nicest neighborhood. And I think now we're on number 8. Our current one was kind of unintentional, but here we are. I just wrote a post about this. I think we've made like $700,000 or $800,000 in beautiful tax-free capital gains. It's just a great way to make money, especially if you're young, because you might not be making that much, but if you're willing to put a little elbow grease into your house on nights or weekends, you can make your house work for you instead of it being a liability. You have to have a place to live, so why not make the house make you money? It's a wonderful strategy. I recommend it for anyone. And the other thing I'll say real quick is there's so much help on the internet now. You can look on YouTube and figure out just about anything. I did not grow up a blue-collar guy. I was a computer programmer, and now I could probably almost build a house with my hands just because of everything I've done on all these flips over time. It's not that difficult. And I want to please be careful. If you feel you're in danger at all or you're a little bit worried, consult a professional, but it's not that bad.
I'm glad you got the disclaimer in there. Just in case, like, don't start prying things open.
What do these wires do?
Yeah. We put them together. Yeah, but I love that, Carl. And I think, like, yeah, you didn't go into it as some sort of home renovation expert. You learned along the way. It took a lot of research, and then it took a lot of trial and error. But and obviously, the biggest pro, I'm glad you mentioned it, is tax-free gains. It's really, really hard to find anything in this world that will give you access to invest in something that you won't have taxed in any way, form, or fashion. But a live-in flip is one of those. But what are the cons, would you say, of living in a live-in flip? Like, that's got to be tough, especially with the kids. Like, you're in this 2-1 and you're working on it at the same time. That's not easy, right?
Oh, yeah. I would not recommend what I did on that specific one. And I'll get into that in a second. But the cons are you're living in a construction zone. I remember like the 3rd or 4th one we did, and this is before kids, but Mindy had just done the laundry. So she's got this basket of like fresh laundry, all these clean shirts, and she had folded up and we're about to put away. And I turn over and she's crying. It was a rough time with the flip. I'm like, what's wrong? So I look down at the basket and there's a layer of drywall dust on top of all these clothes. Ordinarily, that wouldn't have been a tragedy, but I think we were going through a rough time with that particular flip. So yeah, that's the hard thing. You got to be okay with a little bit of discomfort. And I would actually recommend that you don't take on a big job, and maybe not any if you do have children. That was the huge mistake I made with this 2-1. My kids were young. I've got a funny picture of my kids standing in the middle of this, like next to this refuse pile of crap. I think it was the siding from the house. And every moment I spent on the house was a moment I was not spending with my kids. So that one was very financially lucrative, but not life lucrative. I would actually take that one back, even though it was our most profitable one, if I could. So if you do this strategy and you have kids, do it maybe after you've left your job. Because when I did that one, I had a full-time job. And that was a mistake. This one I'm doing now, I do not have a job. So I can just work on it when the kids are in school and put all the tools away as soon as they come home, never work on weekends. And that's the way to do it, or before you have them. Don't do it with young children if you have a job.
Yeah, it makes sense to kind of have that replace your 9-to-5. But if you are looking to hustle, I mean, some folks are in a position where they're going to take on whatever they can in order to get either ahead or get out of the hole that they've dug themselves into, right? But like you said, I mean, especially if you have kids, it's definitely something to consider whether or not it's going to be worth it to you or not. And so, Carl, so how would you suggest our listeners get started with a live and flip if that's something that they're interested in?
Okay, I'm going to go through a couple tips, and some of these might not be implementable, but they might be. The first thing I try to look at is I really want to live in a place that the economy is doing very well. So I know there are certain areas of the Midwest, like where I'm from, certain parts of Chicago have really suffered, and the real estate prices aren't what they were even. I think they're still lower than they were before the Great Recession happened. So I want to live in a place where things are improving, where even if I didn't do anything, I might still do pretty well with the house. Then I want to look at a town that I think is on the upswing. So I live near Boulder, Colorado, and Boulder is already pretty nice, where Longmont still has maybe some parts that are a little bit rough around the edges. But so overall, I think Longmont has more room to improve. It's not quite as pretty as Boulder. Then I try to find a neighborhood where the houses are maybe 30 to 40 years old. So they're outdated, but they're not so old that they have things like knob and tube wiring or ancient plumbing that's leaking or structural issues. I want to find a house that has pretty modern construction. And I also want to find a neighborhood that people are putting money into. So you always hear people talking about, oh, if you look around a city, look at the amount of cranes that are in the city. Because if there's lots of cranes, the city is probably booming economically.
Yeah, it's a sign.
Yeah, so what my sign for a neighborhood is, I walk around the neighborhood and I look for dumpsters. So every dumpster I see is a little gold star. And I'm happy because that means people are putting money into it.
Exactly, yeah.
And I didn't even think of this, but my daughter and I took a walk right before this podcast, and we took a walk around the block, and I saw 3 dumpsters. So that is nice. There's magic in those dumpsters.
I think of it like a domino effect too. When it comes to if you see a few dumpsters, they're bound to be in the next neighborhood over a few months from now. And so sometimes you can tell too, like, okay, this neighborhood, nobody's really looking at it yet, but if they're in the neighborhood next door, it's only a matter of time before they wade into that territory too, right?
Yeah. The other thing I'll say is, it's always better to wait for a great deal than to jump on an okay deal. For this current house we're in now, it took us about 2 years before we took the plunge and bought this house. So we identified the neighborhood and we would watch the listings every single day. If you've done that for a while, you probably know within about 30 seconds if the house is worth pursuing. And then if it is, you can go take a look at it. This is a little bit harder to do now in the COVID environment when housing is on fire, the good kind of fire, not the bad kind of fire. But I think it's still feasible. You could still find deals.
Well, so Carl, you've done some other non-traditional, like less glamorous real estate investing as well. Can you share how those deals have worked out?
Yeah. So we do syndication deals, which is where a pool of people buy something like an apartment building. In my syndication deals, we fix up the apartment building over time, or the syndicator does. You collect rents on a quarterly basis, and then, or you collect, excuse me, payments on a quarterly basis, and then you collect a big payment, hopefully, when the thing sells at the end. I also owned a trailer park, which has some interesting stories.
That was the less glamorous version I was going for.
Yeah, that is much less glamorous. But yeah, we sold that earlier this year. and it is now gone, but it worked out very well for us.
Nice.
Did I hear you say that you didn't make as much money with the trailer park as you would have if you had just stuck that money in the S&P 500?
No, we actually, so the thing about the trailer park was it was in really rough shape. And we spent any dollar that came in, we put right back into it. So we fixed it up, we kicked out all the riffraff, and we made it a better place for the people who live there, which was great. But because of that, we never made much money from it while we owned it. Mm-hmm. But I did the calculation at the end. In the end, we came out $50,000 ahead of where we would if I had invested it in the S&P 500. So I think we came out $350,000, and if it was in the S&P, it would have been $300,000. With every syndication deal I've ever had, the money would have been better in the S&P 500, which is kind of funny because the syndication deals have met their goals. They've done great, but the market has been on such fire they haven't been able to keep up.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what I heard. And I was like, oh, okay, that's just fascinating that you've done well. But still, sometimes the stock market and having your money just sitting in the stock market, in a total stock market index fund or in the S&P 500 has obviously been a great move for decades, but especially over the last decade. But Carl, we want to talk more about index funds and individual stock investing because that's something you've done as well. So we'll get to questions on that right after this.
All right, we're back from the break, and again, we're talking with Carl Jensen. We've just talked about his live and flips, and Carl, I've got to say, I think when I grow up, I kind of want to be like you, because there's something so appealing to me about doing a live and flip, but like you, we've got some young kids, and that would not at all be feasible, but maybe in like 15 years.
Sounds good to you, but not so much our wives, probably. Yeah.
Well, no, Kate's totally down with it. I've talked with her about it, and we're kind of looking ahead like 15 years from now. It's like, you know, we could see ourselves moving, finding a fixer-upper, spending some time, getting the tools, making sure we have the proper equipment to renovate a home ourselves, because the added benefit before selling it, I mean, you're actually able to live in and enjoy this property before you get to sell it. I know you just finished up that, you've got this killer curved deck on the back of your house that kind of goes out to the pool, but that's something that you've been able to enjoy yourself. It's not something that is that you're immediately turning into money, right?
That is correct. It's very satisfying, and that's kind of our goal, to do the work that's going to improve our lives the quickest. So the two things I did first were to finish the basement with another bathroom and to build that deck, because we hang out on that deck all summer. Yeah. We got a great deal on this house because it had this pool, but then it just had this bad piece of chunk of land in back of it. So I'm like, let's put a door here and let's put a deck to get out to the pool. And we sit on that thing and we have parties like every single day of the summer. It's just it's wonderful.
That's awesome. All right. So yeah, I love the live-in flips, and I think it makes sense for a lot of people, and I'm glad you talked about that. But let's talk about stock investing. Carl, you are all about index funds, but you also might potentially be the single greatest stock picker that I actually know, that I actually have a relationship with, that I'm friends with.
I will second that.
Yeah. You bought like Facebook, Google, and Tesla early on. And the value of your individual stock portfolio, is it bigger than your index fund holdings now?
Yeah, it is far bigger. My single greatest holding is, my single greatest holding is VTSAX and VTI, but my stocks are taken together are much bigger than the index funds, which is a precarious place to be, I will say.
Well, I mean, you've seen awesome returns from your portfolio, right? You know, considering that, like, you wouldn't necessarily go back and change things, but why should others maybe not follow your lead and start picking single stocks as well? Why should
they see
other
your
folks
example and they're like, oh, I want to be like Carl, I'm going to do it.
It's like, I'll buy those three stocks also. But I guess we want you to talk a little bit here about index fund investing and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm looking at my portfolio right now. My single most successful investment is Tesla, and I have 625 shares that I bought in 2012, and they're 13,600% return. So that's 136 bagger right there, worth 136 times what I paid.
That's pretty massive.
Yeah,
it's huge. But I got to tell you, if you're looking for some kind of investment thesis as to why I bought that, it was because I thought the Tesla Model S was a cool looking car, and I thought Elon Musk was kind of smart, and I admired his savvy. And on top of that, I'm just stubborn, so I've held on to almost all. But I did sell a couple of shares, which was a mistake a while ago. So that was my thesis, and that's probably not a very good thesis. The thing I think about stock picking is I've got this chart here with the top 10 S&P 500 companies in the year 2000. Can you guess what any of them are? How many of them are still in the top 10?
Oh, jeez. I'm going to guess that zero of them are in their top 10. was Xerox in there back then?
ExxonMobil.
Exxon, definitely.
Exxon was number two. GE was number one, according to this.
Yeah.
Pfizer, Citigroup, Cisco. There might be two. So I see Walmart in here, and I know Microsoft is still in the top 10. I'm not so sure about Walmart, but a lot of these companies are shadows of their former selves. So because disruption happens, and I found the site that shows you what the top 10 S&P holdings were since 1980 on. And in 1980, it was like Standard Oil of Indiana. There's one called Schlumberger. Does anyone even know what the heck that is? Schlumberger. Here's Atlantic Richfield. I don't even know what 4 out of 10 of these companies are. So disruption happens fast. If you look at the top 10 now, they're all tech companies. And if you think those companies won't be disrupted at some point, you're wrong. Like Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft, Alphabet, they're killing it now. But there's a chance these companies won't even be around by 2030. It sounds crazy to say, but think back to 2006. Who was ruling the cell phone game? It was Nokia. It was BlackBerry. All it took was one company to come out with a new phone, Apple, and then Google to pivot to Android. They bought Android, and they demolished those companies. So with one announcement in January of 2007 by Steve Jobs, those other companies were numbered, and who would have guessed it? So you never know what's going to come out and destroy your stock holding. And I'm sure that's going to happen to some of my stocks, and that's the hard thing. When is Facebook? When are kids going to move over to Snapchat? Oh, I think that's already happened, actually. But but Tesla probably won't be around forever. Neither will Amazon. Someone will come out with something that we could never even predict, and it'll be obvious once that thing comes out and once it dominates. Like, oh, yeah, that was easy, but it's totally impossible to predict right now. And that's why index funds are so powerful, because they're self-cleansing. The big company will rise to the top, and you'll be holding that. And the ones that fall out, and you don't have to worry about a thing. The other thing I'll say real quick is holding all these stocks consumes my mental bandwidth. I probably spend about an hour a day looking at Tesla just because I own so much of it. And maybe I'm fooling myself, but I want to have a pretty good idea of if I think the company is still going to be viable by 2030. Mm. And that consumes mental bandwidth, where if I had an index fund, I wouldn't have to worry about any of that. I could just buy that and never look at anything.
I was just talking about this the other day with a friend, how I have a very small amount of crypto, a very small amount. Like it's almost meaningless when it comes to my net worth. And just because it's moving quickly, it's consuming more of my attention. And I'm like, I'm thinking about just getting rid of it because of that, because it's from that standpoint, like even if it went up 500% in a year, it doesn't have any massive impact on the way I live my life, but it does on a day-to-day basis because it's drawing my attention away. And so I think that's a really good point, and one that's not communicated enough, is that index funds are kind of that set it and forget it. Like, go on about your life, live normally, and don't think about your investments very much. And I think that's what that's such an important way to think about your investments. You don't want to be kind of tied up thinking about them constantly.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. I mean, which would you rather be doing? Exercising, improving your health, being at the park with your kid, or reading the latest news story on Tesla on Twitter?
Right.
I guess in your case, you can have a little bit of both. You can you can invest in Tesla and still go looking for dumpsters while you're on your walk. Carl, like, what are your thoughts on spending money that you've made? You know, you're a pretty frugal dude now, and you've also got this massive nest egg, and you're still making money with those flips, maybe some ad revenue through your blog. And so have you kind of gotten to the point where you've crossed over and you feel a little more comfortable spending money? Obviously, you've kind of earmarked some funds here in the next 12 to 18 months for a Tesla, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't necessarily see you being the kind of guy that's going to go out and buy a yacht. But at the same time, I know for a lot of folks,
if Tesla made the yacht, he might.
But for a lot of folks, it can be difficult to spend even just a little bit of money. Let's talk about that kind of crossover point from earning and saving to actually spending some of that money.
Yeah, it's very difficult. My life looks pretty much the same as it did when, like 10 years ago, when our portfolio was probably 10% of what it is now. The thing I found, like the great thing with money, I'll say two things. The great thing is you don't worry so much about the day-to-day life. If something goes wrong and you need to spend money on a a burrito at the airport because you're about to miss your plane and you didn't have a chance to eat before you left. Or I'm trying to think of another silly example. I'm not looking at gas station prices to try to save money on gas. I'm not trying to save a buck here and there on stuff. I'll just go out and buy it. The other thing is, where I have let loose, Joel, we talked about this a little bit a couple days ago, it's so nice to be able to spend money on the things that really make you happy. And for me, that's building better friendships. So one example, when we met last week, I ordered a bunch of barbecue from this famous place in Austin and just shared it with everyone. Everyone's like, how much do I owe you? I'm like, nothing. This is on me. I just wanted to spend time with you because I probably won't see you for the rest of this conference because we're all so busy. So come have some food. We've thought about buying a place in the mountains, another house that would be a gathering spot for friends as well. Just have an open invitation for everyone that I enjoy that's close to me, and I would never charge them anything. They would just all come up with their kids and we'd hang out and have good conversation. So those are the two big things. I don't know if that latter one will ever actually happen, but who knows.
Well, I love it though. You're letting your values inform where your money goes. And I think sometimes it's so easy as maybe you get a raise at work, or it's funny, I just met a listener recently who like 3x her income in a couple of years by getting an advanced degree. And it was like, she was like, I'm still living the same way I was before. And it's because she's letting her values drive the way she lives, not the money influence all the things that she then can purchase. And so, yeah, I appreciate that. I think that's a good way to live. And I think, you know, going back to your happiness point, I think that leads to more happiness. I want to ask you too, Carl, about you've got two girls. We talked about them a little bit earlier. Like, how do you talk to them about money? And like specifically, what do you want them to know before they ultimately leave the nest, before they go off to pursue an entrepreneurship angle or go off to college or whatever they end up doing?
Yeah, we're pretty open about money, so they know our net worth, but I also drill into their heads every day how hard we had to work to get to that net worth. And I also drill into their heads that that money is mom and dad's money. It is not your money. Sometimes they'll say, my older one is almost driving age. She'll be like, oh, dad, I want a car. I'm like, okay, you better start saving a little bit then or figure some stuff out because cars are expensive. Well, you've got the money, dad. I'm like, yeah, I've got the money. You do not have the money. We never give them handouts. If they want something, they have to work for it. And we try to teach them about important basic concepts like compound interest. For example, they have all these chores to do and we pay them 1% a month interest on their on the money they have in the bank account. So
nice.
So every month we go in at the end of the month and, hey, you've got $700 in there. You get $7. The other kid isn't as good of a saver, so she'll have $100. And, dad, why did I only get $1 and Claire got $7? I'm like, well, Claire has more money in her account. When you save more money, you'll get more free money from the miracle of compound interest as well. And I don't know if any of this is staying. I hope it is. It's difficult because you like to think you bring kids up exactly the same, and then they turn out they have their own personalities. And there's a lot to that genetic component that informs and determines the person who they are and how they act. And if they really possess gratification, a real quick story, our old one, even when she was 7, we'd go to Target and she'd be like, well, I want to buy this. I'm like, okay, if you want, you can buy that. But if you do that, you're going to use almost all your money. And you won't have any more in case you want something else in the future. And almost without exception, she would be like, okay, I think you're right. I'm not going to buy this. And the same trick with the younger one. She'd be like, okay, what? I don't care. It's in the cart, Dad. So I don't know what sticks and what does. And I think you have to have a different approach to everyone. And I don't know if I'll even be successful with both of them, or maybe none of them. You could do your best and try to show, but I have no secrets.
Yeah, I bet either way, though, I mean, different folks have different personalities, but either way, I guarantee that those are going to be lessons that stick with them, and they're going to know, they're going to understand how it works, but what they choose to do with that information kind of comes down to them as individuals. But Carl, we've been talking a lot here about some of the different things that you're doing for money. You also are planning to do a lot of things that aren't going to generate money or income. And we saw that like one of your bucket list goals is to bike across the country, unless you're looking to get some massive sponsorship or something like that. That's probably not going to make you much money. It probably shouldn't cost you a whole lot of money either. But I guess we wanted to see if Joel and I, if we could kind of join up with you on that and maybe get it on the calendar? Is that possible?
I think that sounds completely awesome. We could have like a how-to money bicycle tour. You could have meetups in every town. In some of the small towns in Iowa where there's like 50 people, we might get like one person, or it might be a cow or something like that.
I was going to say, we have some cow listeners out there in Iowa for sure. So
as long as we can just bike from one brewery to the next, yes. I think that would be enough to literally fuel me for another day. So
I think that is a worthwhile goal, and that would be a great way to do a bike ride.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, Carl, let's get that on the calendar. I don't know, maybe 2023? I don't know. You start noodling it out, and we'll get it down. But my friend, this was such a fun conversation. So much good information. Always just good to hang out with you as well. So thank you for coming on our show. And where can our listeners kind of find out more about you and what you're up to?
They can find me at my blog, which is 1500days.com, just the number, 1500. And I have a podcast too, which is milehighfi.com. Joel, your interview will probably be out by the time this one is published, but if not, you'll see it there soon.
Awesome. Very nice. And of course, we'll make sure to link to all of that, Carl. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. That seemed to be like 5 minutes long, but here we are an hour later.
So true. When there's a good conversation, it does feel like it doesn't
take time.
Flies, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. So we are actually recording this shortly after FinCon, which is the conference we referred to earlier on in the episode. And I feel like our voices are just kind of recovering because we just spent 4 days talking nonstop.
With our kind of people.
With our people at an elevated volume. Because it's just, yeah, it's constant, it's nonstop. But I'm so glad we were able to talk to Carl today, talking about all the different things that make up his life. Joel, what was your big takeaway from this episode?
All right, so it's tough, man, because I feel like there was a lot of good stuff that Carl said. But I could go with a lot of things, but I think I'm going to go with the fact that he said FI won't make you happy. Like, reaching financial independence, I think sometimes people assume that, well, if I just had enough money, like,
and all my problems are going to be fixed.
Exactly. And that is not the way it works. And so you have to work towards happiness now. You have to work towards pursuing the things that you love and having a lifestyle that isn't all work and no play. You have to be even in the middle of trying to save more and invest more and eventually reaching that point where you don't have to work anymore if you don't want to. Well, it's not going to be satisfying if you haven't cultivated yourself as a person along the way, if you haven't developed hobbies and cultivated community. Those are the kind of things that you need to be doing right here, right now. And financial independence, you're probably going to be a little bored, a little depressed if you get to that point and you don't have any of those things to go alongside of it. So I think sometimes in the FIRE crowd, that is one thing that I've seen over and over. There's a lot of good happening, good news being spread in that community. But there's also that tendency where it's like, I'm living for the future. I'm living for 10 years from now. And we don't want to find ourselves in that position, that's for sure. And I think, Carl, that was some really good advice. And he's living just an incredibly balanced life these days.
Yeah.
And it's fun to see.
Yeah. I think my big takeaway actually is going to have to do with balance as well, because he touched on how when he was doing that live and flip of that, you know, the most lucrative live and flip that they did, how looking back, how he actually may not have done it. He's got this picture in his mind. Maybe it was an actual picture that he took of his kids playing like on a waste heap of a bunch of construction debris, which you always find yourself with around a home as you're working on it. There's just crap everywhere. But I think that was just good for me to hear, because I can be tempted to want to take on these projects because I find a lot of satisfaction in working with my hands and changing spaces. That's a part of why I touched on his ability to enjoy the patio that they have on the back of their house. I kind of followed him as they worked on that thing, seeing his family out there by the pool. I see stuff like that, and I immediately want to do the same thing. Maybe not dig my own pool by hand, but that is also something I've actually said to you, Joel, that I'm going to do, where I'm just like, you know, it doesn't have to be like a traditional full-size pool. What if it's just kind of like a plunge pool? I think I could totally do that myself, save a ton of money, but also enjoy it.
Because that's on the exterior, that's probably a little easier to do while you've got kids.
But
if you're like, I'm gutting the whole house and we're going to be like peeing in a hole, I mean, that's the kind of thing you don't want to be doing, right?
But it's less too just the dust and the debris, but just the amount of time that it takes, because he said that he had the standard 9-to-5 and he was doing the home renovation during the evenings and on the weekends. And that is time that you can't get back with your kids. And so I'm tempted anytime I hear success stories and I see befores and afters, that totally gets me every single time. But to hear him say that, that's only reinforced my desire to make sure that I pump the brakes a little bit. And Kate and I have had this discussion before. We truly could see ourselves down the road being live-in flippers, but not until the kids are out of the house.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
I feel you on that.
But that was my big takeaway.
Obviously, great combo. And
yes,
we'll put the links to Carl's site and his podcast in the show notes. But yeah, Matt, what were your thoughts on the beer we had today? This was Old Chub by Oscar Blues. We picked a Colorado beer because that's where Carl lives. This is a Scotch ale. It's been around a long time.
It has. What
do you think?
Yeah, in general, this style has a kind of a soft spot in my heart because one of our favorite local breweries, Monday Night Brewing, one of their first beers, one of their first successful beers that they were brewing in their literal garage was a Scotch Ale, Drafty Kilt Scotch Ale. And so because of that, I have fond memories of Scotch Ales being kind of like legitimate craft beers. That was one of the first, I feel like, truly Atlanta beers that I had. But Old Chub, a fantastic beer. I mean, it's a Scotch Ale, so what that means, it's got that, it's dark. It's a little sweet. It's got that malty backbone. Virtually no bitterness at all. I mean, maybe like the tiniest bit that you would get. Like, for instance, if you've got a piece of toast and it's been toasted maybe a touch too long, you've kind of got that bitterness going on, but virtually no bitterness from the hops. Really enjoyable beer, and glad that this is something that you and I got to enjoy here on the episode today, man. What were your thoughts?
So, to me, Scotch Ale is basically in between a stout and a brown ale.
There you go.
It's kind of riding that center point. It's a little bit darker than that brown, but it's still got that lighter body. And so, especially early on in my craft beer days, I found myself gravitating towards Scotch Ales a lot.
Yeah.
although there aren't that many people that produce them, Monday Night was the one,
yes,
I was probably drinking the most.
Exactly.
But this one's great. And if you do, like, you're like, I don't know, stouts are a little big for me, or brown ales are a little too boring for me, try to find a Scotch Ale. And this is a great one to check out. Old Chub by Oscar Blues. But that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want those show notes, links to the stuff we mentioned about Carl, you can find that up in our show notes at howtomoney.com.
And if you haven't left us a review yet, please head over to Apple Podcasts, where you can leave us a solid rating and review over there. That helps to ensure that others know about the podcast, and that is what helps Joel and I to continue to create amazing content for you multiple times a week. So Joel, that's going to be it. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.